nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We've reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We've appealed to their native justice and magnanimity. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. We must therefore hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. That's such an interesting phrase. I think we all know that the Declaration of Independence was a declaration of independence from the British Empire, but it was also a formal declaration of war by the new United States. And don't forget that when independence was declared, the war had been raging for over a year. However, less attention is paid to the fact that the Declaration of Independence can also be read as a declaration of civil war, a war between colonists who were loyal to the British Empire and those who were willing to risk their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor in a war of independence. So we can read that line, we hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends, as an implicit declaration of war against fellow Americans. This is the final warning. If you do not join our struggle now, you are the enemy. If you do not join us now, we are at war with you too. And so what we have here is the first American Civil War, declared while simultaneously declaring independence. So who were those people who chose to rebel? And who were the people who chose to remain loyal? And who were the people who just didn't care? What influenced their decisions? Was it money? Was it religion? Was it race? Was it geography? Were families divided? Were neighbors divided? What would happen if you met your neighbor or your brother or your uncle on the battlefield? Would you shoot him? And would he shoot you? These are hard questions to ask now, 250 years later. Imagine how hard it was for the people who had to choose a side in 1776. So today we're going to explore these early divisions in America with an expert on the conflicting loyalties of the American people during the War of Independence, Professor Serena Zabin. Welcome, Serena.
Thank you for having me.
Serena is the Stephen R. Lewis Jr. Professor of History and the Liberal Arts at Carleton College. She is the author of Dangerous Economies, Status and Commerce in Imperial New York, also the New York Conspiracy Trials of 1741, Daniel Horsemaiden's Journal of the Proceedings, and lastly, the prize-winning book, The Boston Massacre of Family History. So, Serena, I'm always struck by that very powerful phrase, enemies in war, in peace, friends. What do you make of that phrase?
You're right. It's very powerful. It suggests that the same people, depending on their politics, are either people you love or people you don't. And to me, that's a very political statement. It makes a lot of sense in the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, exists precisely to make distance, right, between America and people who are supporting independence and everybody else. It is an aspirational statement. I do not think, in fact, that most people, even the most committed political people who signed that declaration, actually found it within them to treat people entirely differently, especially the people they knew, depending on their politics. People still really felt ties of friendship and family and other forms of loyalty, sometimes even economic loyalty, business, their business connections never quite disappear throughout the war, even as people did do vicious and violent things also to people they knew, to their neighbors, and sometimes even to their families. in the name of politics.
Yeah, we'll get into some of those specifics as we go on. But maybe we can just start by roughly charting the historical progress here. So, you know, Lexington and Concord is about 15 months before the Declaration of Independence. So if we're trying to just like kind of chart a path, what type of people are like supporting the revolution at Lexington and Concord? And then we get to the Declaration of Independence and then it carries on. Can we just kind of talk through that historical progress a little bit?
Sure. I'd actually put the moment that folks are trying to decide if they can still be loyal to Parliament, Britain, the king, and care deeply about the protest movement to 1774. I think it's the Coercion Acts, right, what get to be known as the Intolerable Acts, that really do make it impossible for people who wanted to say, I am all in on these kind of political arguments about the ways in which colonies are being treated, but I'm not okay with the ways that the Sons of Liberty and other people have been managing kind of street violence and other pieces. After the Port of Boston is closed, people are really having a hard time with food. And there are other acts that are passed, including, of course, the Quebec Act, which I know you've talked about elsewhere on this podcast. I think it's at that moment that the line between patriot and loyalist becomes more clear. That's not to say that people are not still crossing back and forth between that line, and many people are looking for a space either in between them or maybe underneath them, right? Trying really hard not to have to claim a space in either place. But certainly by the time we get to Lexington and Concord, we have people who are clearly committed to one side or another, because that's partly what war does, right? When Massachusetts starts telling towns to create a militia that are going to be ready for violence, right? At any moment, not the violence that they may have initially once imagined, which honestly was primarily against Native nations in the 17th century, but now against a British army, which they did sort of foresee coming. When Massachusetts and other New England towns start putting together these bands of their militia, they are asking folks, men, to show up, right? And when you have to show up with a gun and be willing to shoot somebody, that is the moment that you are putting your politics out in front of your neighbors, in front of your family, and saying, I will stand up for this group of people, if not actually this idea, right? So militias, I think, are a place. War is a place where folks are really forced to take a side.
Just 2 points that I'd like to follow up here. One is the Sons of Liberty. I'm going to ask you to just describe them. And mm-hmm. I had never considered this before, but of course, peer pressure is a huge factor here. But why don't you just start by reminding us who the Sons of Liberty were?
The Sons of Liberty were a political club, kind of started as a drinking club, I think. They emerge out of the Stamp Act protests. And while they exist as clubs of men, right? So they're Sons of Liberty. They exist all over the British colonies, not even just in the ones that end up becoming the United States. They become most active in New England. And then eventually through these committees of correspondence, which they sort of seed and become the seeds for, right? And they start writing to each other, that's the correspondence, right? And urging each other on towards more and more acts of protest, they become the voice of the most radical arguments for independence. So these are men who have been practicing the language of politics for a long time. So in Massachusetts, that includes some of the most famous people out there, John Hancock, John Adams, you know, Sam Adams. Those are the sons of liberty who become major players, right? But they practice in a much smaller space that's primarily taverns.
Interesting. The next point was peer pressure. So when the militias are mustered, and if all of the young men and older men are assembling at the town square and you're conspicuously absent, people are going to start asking questions. So even if you're sitting on the fence, if the militia is summoned and you're not showing, I mean, I guess people are going to throw around the word coward or traitor quite a bit, yeah?
Yes. And so in 1775, especially before Lexington and Concord, you know, before there's actually any kind of said battle, you can explain away your absence, right? You can say, oh, you know, I had got an injury, fell over my hoe. You know, I mean, people say that, it's true. And, you know, they don't show up. I'm like, oh yeah, so sorry. That piece is fine. After Lexington and Concord, however, as the call for troops spreads throughout New England and then even further, right? And as people start to come, I mean, and they're starting to come by, you know, if April 19th at dawn is the shooting in Lexington and Concord, you know, by the 20th, you have people coming from New Hampshire, from Connecticut, from Rhode Island. And as they are chasing the British back that night, right? Other lots of militias are back into Boston and then start that siege. All kinds of American men and some women who come with them are working hard to show that they really believed in this movement that's going to push back on British overreach. And it still looks a little like British overreach at that moment, right? It looks like what's really happening is the British Army is taking the gunpowder supplies that towns feel entitled to for their own safety, that they've always had or always for 100 years, you know, but for a long time, they've been able to claim. And so this is still in lots of ways an argument about overreach. But as those militia groups stay around Boston, that will become the nucleus of the Continental Army.
Right. I find that as we talk about these things, and as I've done with many of my guests, we focus so much on the Patriots and the John Adams and the Ben Franklin and all of this. And I just feel that loyalism is lost entirely. And even in just the first couple minutes here, we're just like forgetting about loyalists. And it strikes me as being very unfair. So I do want you to focus now a little bit on loyalism. Let's just get to know them and understand that maybe, you know, they're not necessarily cowards or traitors or anything. They're complex people making reasonable decisions, right?
Absolutely. So the thing about loyalists is that, you know, there's a couple of different sets of people that we can now identify as loyalists. They're divided into people who get to write about what they're thinking, and they primarily organize their own thinking after the war is over, in large parts, to justify and explain as a coherent political philosophy why it is that they were opposed to the American Revolution, right? So some people are writing pamphlets at the time and arguing with what they felt were, you know, the radical edges of the Patriot movement. But most people who are loyalists are really named that by their neighbors who don't like their actions, whatever they may be, right? They seem somehow either completely committed to a British army or they are insufficiently committed to a Patriot cause. There are things that some people, especially men, do that make it clear that they're going to be loyalists. They are going to stand in the middle of a crowded tavern and drink a toast to George III And it's so clear that they are doing this to tweak someone's nose, right?
Is this
And
what we would now call trolling in the tavern?
Exactly. So there's plenty of that, right? Are they really loyalists? Probably. Do they also have other reasons that have a lot to do with their community and the people they're drinking with? Yes. It's never a clear political commitment, right? And that's why actually thinking about the Sons of Liberty as a relatively small group of folks who practice talking politically is worthwhile, because most of the rest of the people living in America are not like that. Most of them, they might read or overhear some other pieces being read, but most of them are just trying to make sense of the world that they're in. So they become loyal to the British Army when the British Army shows up and demands loyalty. And then they are loyal to Congress or the Continental Army when the Army shows up or Congress shows up and demands loyalty. For the largest part of the war, that's what most people are doing. When the war is over, then people also a little bit can put their money where their mouths are, right? And they go to Canada, they leave with the army. And there are other moments when they leave with the army too. But for the most part, during the war, unless you are deeply committed, most people are looking just to stay alive.
That's a really interesting aspect of all wars, of course. And after the fact, as we are rewriting our justifications for what we do, I guess people haven't always just been honest about it and said, well, when the British Army came, I was like, okay, I'm supporting you. And then when the American or the Patriot Army or the Continental Army came, it was like, okay, yeah, woohoo. And I think we see that throughout history. I'm thinking of many examples, World War II, for example. You know, people were just like, okay, well, I guess I have to be I have to support the Germans or whatever. And then right. The Americans came, it's like, yay, we're free. Woo-hoo.
We've always been here. Yes. I mean, and you know, of course, and this has been true, no doubt, since the Battle of Marathon. But I think at the time, politicians and officers misread what's going on, and maybe they too are hopeful or aspirational. So certainly the British officers and to some degree the politicians keep thinking that there are these pockets of loyalists, that they just have to kind of free them from the oppression of their patriot neighbors, and they will flock to the army, they will flock to the British standard, essentially, right? So initially they think, oh, if we can just isolate First Boston or just isolate New England, then this whole rebellion will just sort of dissipate. And that never really happens, right? And so every time they're sort of surprised by how little support there is. And even when people do genuinely flock to the British, like once they capture New York, right, and it becomes a British stronghold, absolutely, people of all genders and all races, including a large number of formerly enslaved people, go to New York, say, we are here to support you. We believe in what you are arguing for, what we believe in the British crown. Lots of those people, once they're in New York and they're living under martial law, they're like, I didn't really think that this was the kind of British liberty that I was all in for. It turns out, oh, you know, they are not actually that much more likely to treat people of color with dignity. Not at all, right? And, you know, they're not even wealthy white guys who think that they've been oppressed by their patriot neighbors and come to the British think, I don't really like living under martial law. I don't like being told what to do by some, you know, 18-year-old officer. That's not fun. That's not what I had in mind. So lots of times, what people imagine loyalty to be turns out not to work for them, right?
I'm struck by this idea that the British Army and the British politicians had clearly misread the situation. And I'm wondering, how did they misread the situation so much that they thought that there would be this, you know, counter-revolution but they could never find it. And I'm first reminded, of course, of the bad intelligence that preceded the congressionally authorized invasion of Canada. And they were hoping that, oh, yeah, there will be these pockets of patriotism that we'll find, and Canada will say, yes, we're joining the War of Independence. Never happened, really. So looking back, why do you think the British military and the British political class misread that situation so badly?
I think that there's probably two reasons. One is there are Americans who are pushing that narrative really hard to both the army and politicians. There are, in New York, for example, Oliver Delancey, who puts together essentially a loyalist militia. And he promises that there are going to be tons of people flocking to him. And he gets, you know, he definitely gets some support, right? And so the British officers, you know, just sort of expand from this one example to think, oh, well, if it can happen here, it can happen in so many other places. So part of it is that there are Americans making that argument to them. And the British, you know, with some justification, think, well, these are the people with, you know, boots on the ground. They should know what's going on. And they get a little played. So I think that's one thing. And the other one is that, you know, it's an expensive war. And I know that this has come up in other moments too, that as George III, among others, but some of his ministers, just kind of commit deeply to winning this war, they're looking for ways that it can happen. And they just keep hoping that this is going to be the last battle, that somehow it will not require just pouring more and more troops and more money into North America, but that actually the support is already there. So I think some of it's wishful thinking and some of it's getting a little played.
Yeah, there are all these modern examples now that I'm thinking of. Leaders far away wanting an outcome and then selecting intelligence or evidence that's like, oh yeah, this is the right way to go.
There's a more junior officer who's on the ground in South Carolina, and he writes to his superior, he's so disgusted with this problem of the loyalty oaths. And he says of the people around him, he says, they swallow the oaths of allegiance to the king and Congress alternately with as much ease as your lordship does poached eggs.
That's great.
I mean, it's just so great. He's like, look, you know, I can see it. They're, you know, nobody ever means what they say. So you just can't trust it.
Yeah. But if a report is going back, like, we got 1,000 people in this village to swear loyalty to King George, you can see how that intelligence or that letter could be read by someone in London saying, ah, you know, there is loyalty here. This is worth more. But the second thing that I wanted to say has to do with George Washington and his fairly catastrophic generalship after the Continental Congress authorizes the Continental Army. He loses a bunch of battles, and some would argue he lost them because he didn't really understand the correct strategy to win, which was just, as long as you have an army in the field, even if it's not actually fighting anyone, it means the revolution is alive. The worst thing you can do is have a decisive battle and lose the army, and then the revolution would be over. So people would argue that until Washington changed his approach, he was kind of playing into the British hands. And as soon as he changed his approach to an insurgency, just that like drawing out of the war for long meant that all of these intelligence failures that I guess I've been calling now, all of these intelligence failures by the British would mount up and it would be inevitable that the Patriots win.
Yes, I mean, you know, as well as I do, inevitability is maybe not the best approaches to thinking about, especially that war. It's got many moments that things might have gone south for different people. And, you know, and even the battles that one side wins, nobody's sure about how any of this is ever going to play out, I guess. But it's true that the army, and I think maybe this is the biggest point I want to make, that both the Continental Army and the British Army are probably the biggest factors in determining people's loyalties,
right? Just their presence
especially
in your region.
Their presence.
Right.
Yeah. You know, Howe like goes through South Carolina and North Carolina too, and he just makes these pronouncements. If you haven't joined, you know, the local loyalist militia in the next 3 days, we're going to hang you. And then he leaves hoping that this is going to work, right? And, you know, and people are like, oh, sure, I'll sign up. And then he leaves, and then that, you know, the militia dissipates. And the same thing happens, honestly, when Green shows up also in the South. It doesn't really matter. But when the army comes to you, and this is true for women as well as men, right? When the army comes to you, you need to figure out how to negotiate the war. And it's rarely about your political principles. You know, if it were, you wouldn't be sitting there waiting for the army to come at you.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about more about the experience of women and their tendencies for loyalism or patriotism or neutrality? How do we like to tell that story of the war?
I think that story of the war is as mixed for women as it is for men. There are loyalist women, there are patriot women who are deeply committed. There are lots of women who, again, are just trying to make it through. But the ways in which both we know what they did and the ways in which they show their commitment are, in fact, quite different from men, largely because they don't fight. And so often the odes that the army asks for are, you know, to pick up arms, right? But what Congress actually tells all the states to do is to demand a loyalty oath that just sort of says, we support the idea of the justice of the rebellion, right? And that's actually a claim that they can demand women make. And so sometimes women do indeed sign loyalty oaths, but do they mean that any more than the men who desert immediately? That is so hard to say. Likewise, in Connecticut in 1779, you know, Connecticut's a really interesting place to look at these conflicts between loyalists and patriots, because it's not actually in a war zone, but it's so close to war zones. But when the British Navy comes and burns the coast in 1779 that summer, all of these people who have signed loyalist oaths literally come running out of their houses, waving these pieces of paper at the British officer saying, look, I am a friend, right? And most of the men are gone. These are mostly women trying to protect their homes. And the army says, or the Navy, that there are moments, hours when they say, okay, yes, we will not burn. We won't burn the Anglican church. That's right. That is kind of our church, right? We won't burn this house that is clearly owned by somebody who has signed a loyalist oath. And then 3, 4, 5 hours later, they're like, actually, we've decided we're just going to burn the whole town. And they burn them all, right? So in the end, when the oaths don't mean anything, even when they are being used for the purpose that people signed them, I think nobody feels that their political loyalties are really being that respected.
The loyalty oath history is so fascinating, but the way you tell it now, I'm wondering why, in fact, a loyalty oath meant anything. Because if people are being coerced or just changing their minds, and if, thirdly, if you make a loyalty oath to the British and they destroy your home anyway, like, what was the point of this loyalty oath? Who was trying to prove what to whom? Or were these, like, so based in some sort of code of honor that if you made an oath, it meant like, and if you then broke your oath, you would be like ostracized by, I don't know, all of society or something?
I mean, there's some hope, of course, that that's what oaths and parole and giving your word are going to do, right? I mean, that is certainly how oaths function, that you swear a thing and that if you give it up, then you've somehow impugned your mortal soul. But that doesn't seem to be functioning very well. So I think in some ways, the oaths are useful rhetorical and kind of PR pieces, right? So in fact, a general can say, I got this many people to sign off on a thing, and that becomes useful for the politics of saying there is going to be support for our side. I mean, there is a lot of shaming that happens in these neighborhoods. And that becomes a way that neighbors keep an eye on each other because this is a local world for the most part. So they do some work, they just don't do all the work that people at the top think they're going to. But I do think that they maybe do some local work.
So we've been discussing this, now that I understand it, a much bigger middle ground, people who are not really committed to either side. In previous episodes, guests have suggested a third, a third, a third, loyalists, patriots, neutral. From what you're suggesting here, I'm thinking that actually over half of people are in the middle.
That's exactly right. So the third comes from John Adams, right? Much later, post-war. And it's absolutely back of the envelope thinking. But, more careful studies indicate to us that we see something like 20% are committed loyalists, maybe a little more like 40% are going to be committed patriots, and the rest, right, which is like, I don't know how much math I've
40%.
got left there. 40%, thank you. At least, and are pretty much trying to keep their heads down. A few of them are committed neutralists, right? And largely those are Quakers, people who are like, I just don't do war. And by the way, here we're talking entirely about British colonists, right? We're not talking about indigenous nations. Those numbers play out really differently. But some of that 40% of the patriots, that can waver also. So I always imagine this is between 2 and 3 fifths, and there's all like a whole crew of people wandering back and forth across that line.
We mentioned the Sons of Liberty, the hardcore patriots, but we have kind of passed over the hardcore loyalists. Can we describe those hardcore loyalists a bit better? The true believers?
Yeah. So some of the men who are hardcore loyalists who write about it, right? So we really know where their own politics sit are people like, oh, William Franklin, right? Nice famous example, who's governor of New Jersey, whose father is super, they don't have a great relationship to begin with. And when he commits hard to supporting the king, Benjamin, his dad, is not pleased, and that's pretty much the end of their relationship. So you have people
Wait,
in
sorry.
political.
William Franklin was Benjamin Franklin's son.
Yes.
And he was already, I didn't realize he was already governor of New Jersey.
Yes. So, you have people who are deep in, right? They're American born, all of that, but they have positions of power. Or famously, thanks to Hamilton, you have Samuel Seabury, who writes these really, I'm going to say, lengthy but witty pamphlets about how much he thinks, especially the First Continental Congress, is completely out of hand, where he's just sort of says, politically, I cannot be on board with you. But there's also people who are a lot less articulate on paper, who do join these loyalist militias, so we know that that's what they're doing. Like people, especially, for example, in North Carolina, right, which has a very violent civil war going on between mostly farmers, is who's living in North Carolina at this point. And you absolutely have people who join a loyalist militia, are happy to support the army when it shows up, are possibly playing out some older hostilities against their neighbors that predate these particular politics, but get kind of pushed on to the contemporary politics at that moment, right? And then the other really obvious and really interesting question is, especially enslaved and formerly enslaved people who join often a loyalist side, in part initially in 1776, at least, because they are promised freedom from slavery if they stick, starting with Lord Dunmore's proclamation in 1776. But the army and the navy continue to make that proclamation, that promise to enslaved people throughout the war. And depending on where you are and which piece of the British army you end up with, sometimes they follow through on that promise. And sometimes you might end up working for part of the army where the kind of detail you've been put on is so deadly that you don't actually make it out of the army, right? And that absolutely happens to both men and women. But there are lots of formerly enslaved people who leave with the British Army, who create these free black communities, first in Canada and then in England, and then eventually around the world, as Cassandra Pires has shown us, right? Even in Australia. And many of them do feel deeply committed to Britain as a possible beacon of liberty, or more liberty than they think that they're going to get in the new United States.
Well, and I do maybe just as we come to an end here, I do want to think a little bit about that word consanguinity in the Declaration of Independence, in the words, our British brethren. There is this sense, the language is very clear in the Declaration of Independence that they are speaking to their brothers, which is our British brethren. So it's clear that loyalism has a deep familial flavor to it. I'm just wondering now, though, those ideas that we see in the Declaration of Independence about like self-government and being angry with some of the overreach of the British Empire and King George, like to what extent were lots of these loyalists like half on board with the ideas expressed in the Declaration of Independence?
So there's lots of interesting things in what you just pointed to there. Certainly, everybody who is at all attached to thinking in political terms, whether or not they're very articulate, whether or not they're being published, like Tom Paine, does think about politics in familial terms. So the idea that the king is the father, right, and that obedience and loyalty are understood as part of a political family. Everybody understood that as metaphor. That was really significant to them, right? That organized the way they think about politics. So to talk about consanguinity, to talk about brethren, absolutely is to say we all once were children of the same father. And now look what's happened. So there is the sense that people are angry at each other. There's an emotional piece here, right? There's a piece of loss that happens when when families split. And that is some of what I think is hinted at least in that passage. So I do think that everybody understood this language of loyalty as a language of family, whether or not you felt that loyalty to the king means that, that's what makes you loyal, or loyalty to your siblings in some ways, right? The people who really need to live their lives as interconnected, right? All these people who had been under the king are now saying, this father is no good. That also was something that everyone understood. And so that's what makes this a civil war, right? Is that people actually have a shared sense of politics They just don't have a shared sense of how it's supposed to play out. And I think it's not just between brothers, although we spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, what you see when you pick up arms. In 1776, now Lucy Flucker, who will become Lucy Knox, right, marries to Henry Knox, who will become, you know, Washington's right-hand man and the Secretary of War. You know, she writes to her sister who marries a British officer and leaves Boston after the siege. She never sees her again. She says, how dreadful is this war? Brother against brother, sister against sister, she says, right? It's also a sister's war. And it feels like this is breaking her heart. Lucy never sees her mother again. She never sees her sister again. And it's a very dramatic letter. I will say that they all survive the war, and Henry and Lucy Knox end up with all of the family land, which is most of the state of Maine. And Henry Knox and his sister-in-law, Hannah, who's then Urquhart, who's married this British officer and then had kind of a juicy divorce, they correspond through the 1790s and beyond about this property. They're quite close, right? So it feels terrible in the moment, but some families actually manage to pull it back together.
It's a fascinating story that encapsulates so much of what we discussed. I have a kind of meta-historical question now. Okay. So, you know, I've been pushing this idea that loyalism hasn't been sufficiently studied, understood, or disseminated. The obvious reason why this is the Patriots won and loyalists are bad. And now I might throw the name Benedict Arnold. Everyone knows who a Benedict Arnold is. What's going on with history and politics that we've kind of totally, except for the word Benedict Arnold, the worst thing you could ever call an American, why is it that we've just skipped over entirely loyalism?
I'd suggest there are two reasons why that might happen. So one, as you suggested, right, is that the loyalists essentially lose the argument in that part of America. And so they don't get to write those histories. And the histories that are being written, starting with Mercy Otis Warren, right, she starts writing before the Constitution is even dry, they are writing explanations of the war and of why the sacrifice is worth it and of what they hope this country is going to become and the ways in which they think people have already gone wrong. But essentially, there's a bedtime story about where is it that the United States comes from. And it comes from a comforting story of people who triumphed over wrong.
The evil empire. Yeah.
The evil empire. So that is unsurprising. That is a truly entwined with the Constitution, right? I mean, that's a story that people have been writing for a long, long, long time. So part of it certainly is that, you know, this is a national narrative, right? And the national narrative is about the winners. Okay. But the other piece, too, is that lots of people who were not on board with the revolution kind of quietly come back. They renegotiate all kinds of ways of staying in touch, as I said, of remaking the relationships with their families, with their communities. And some people absolutely never make it back. Either they leave or, of course, they die before it's over. But there is a desire to reintegrate those loyalists, right? And other historians have worked on this. And that is part of the story also. So it's a story of forgetting. It's deliberate. People who actually were loyalists, they want that forgotten.
Yeah, but it also strikes me that then as history moves forward, there's an important story of reconciliation that we have to remember.
Yeah, I think it's an important story. I think that's really beautifully put, that there's also a kind of post-revolution story of actual reconciliation, even while there's still a kind of public argument about who's really a patriot, how do we celebrate the revolution at 25 years, once it's over, 50 years, once it's over, right? All of those things, there's still people alive, but then they're celebrating some things publicly. They're not celebrating the reintegration of the loyalists, but in fact, that is what is happening. And I think you're right that now this is a good moment to look back and think, okay, everybody who was opposed to the kind of radical edge that becomes the revolution didn't just take their balls and go home, right, and leave. They didn't all go to England or to Canada. Some of them were like, actually, it's my home. I'm going to make it work.
I'm rereading that last line from the Declaration of Independence. We must therefore hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace friends. It strikes me as actually that might be very intentional, the sequence there. First, we have enemies in war, and second, we have in peace friends. That even though the Declaration is a declaration of civil war, as we've been saying, but also it ends with in peace friends. So there is like this beautiful opening of the future horizon that like, hey, we are enemies at war, but if we're at peace, we can be friends again and maybe even brothers again.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think that when Congress is approving this in 1776, they have any idea what peace is going to look like. Course, but I think they know at the time that they certainly have friends in England. They don't want to alienate all of them anyway, but that, you know, nothing lasts forever. They knew that as well as any of us, right? This is the beginning of a war. I don't think anybody thought it was going to take 8 years, but they did think when it was over, if they actually didn't get swallowed back up, that there was going to be a space for remembering all of these people who were their family.
Beautiful. I ask all my guests as we end, 250 years after the Declaration of Independence, what are the big takeaways that you have?
I think following on our conversation here, that it is a wonderful time to reflect on what it means to do history, to think about history, and to think about empathy for all of these people who lived in the past, who made choices that we might not agree with, that we often don't understand because we don't know enough about them and what they did. We may think that all of these folks who just wanted to keep their heads down were actually kind of wimps or uncommitted. But I think that it's a good moment to remember that all of the people who live in the past, as those who live in the present, deserve our respect, right, for the lives that they lived. And if we can try to take seriously the choices that they made in the context in which they made them, I think we might understand better where we came from.
Thank you very much, Professor Serena Zabin.
Thank you, Andy, for having me on. Super fun. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.